first year revenue, we did $1 million+. The next year revenue, seven times. So we were like $7 million the second year. And then third year, we did $35 million.
Hi, I'm Luke Hanson McDonald, and welcome to Beyond the Family Business. We have a great interview for you today with Nirav Gandhi. He's a good friend of mine who I met in my MBA. Nirav has a truly inspirational story. Him and his brother came to Canada as immigrants, as young boys, and have built an incredible business in the e-commerce space, over $100 million in revenue and a crazy amount of different products. Their entrepreneurial story is truly unbelievable. As well, they've built a very impressive investment portfolio of real estate, and they're now getting into their third venture, which Nirav gets into. So enjoy part one of a two-part interview with my good friend, Nirav Gandhi.
Four questions to start. What's your name? Where were you born? Where do you live now? And what do you do for a living?
For sure. So my name is Nirav Gandhi. I was born in Mumbai, and then my family immigrated here when I was 7 years old. And now I run a couple of businesses, one being e-commerce, second being a real estate portfolio. And another one we just started was a recruitment agency that helps companies in Western world hire or open up satellite offices in India.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, you actually, I think you sent me that website before.
Yeah.
Cool.
And we actually got our first client.
Yeah, awesome.
Which I'm super excited about.
That's great. So, you were born in Mumbai and moved to Canada when you were seven?
When I was seven, yeah.
What was that like? I assume must have been a pretty big culture shock.
It was like a big deal back then. Going to a foreign country was a very, very big deal. This was back in 1997. We obviously wore suits on the plane. As kids, we bought suits. My parents dressed us up.
Really?
It was our first time on a plane.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very, very... and then, like, you know, hundreds of people came to drop us off at the airport, like all our relatives, every one of them. It was like a big moment for the family.
Wow.
And then when we got here, it was definitely a culture shock. One, it was February, so it was cold as hell. I was not used to the cold. And it's what I distinctly remember is there was a different smell.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know what it was. It's like foamy smell
that's what Canada smells like.
Yeah, it was different. Maybe it was the apartment buildings we're staying at, or it was just, I think it's just a different atmosphere, but that's what I distinctly remember.
Oh, that's super interesting. I obviously, like, I've been to Mumbai with you and yeah. Have been there a couple other times. So I always think about, like, the smell of going to another country.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never really thought about what does Canada smell like. So Canada smells foamy.
It's at least where I was living,
yeah.
It was different. Like, as a kid, I was like, hey, this is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So why did your parents decide to move to Canada?
A couple of factors. I think one was better opportunity for themselves and for the kids. Second was health reasons. My father's health was deteriorating in Mumbai. The air pollution was bad. And then, you know, he has diabetes, asthma. And then he just, I guess, needed a little change in life. It was a big, drastic step. So what he initially did was he sent my uncle first. So he got settled. My uncle brought his family, and then my dad came.
Okay, and then so you had family when you moved
well,
here.
Well, my dad's brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's the first one who came. And then he settled, and then my dad came. And then we all lived together in this one apartment building.
Oh, cool. I don't know if I knew that. So, moved here. What did your parents do when they first moved to Canada?
Factory. So, the only thing they could do, back in India, my mom has never worked. And I'm so fascinated because now when I think back at it, my mom was 28 and my father was 35 when he came. So it was exactly my age when he came to Canada. So that's one thing I'm super fascinated about. And when they came here, my mom doesn't know English. My dad probably knows broken English. So it's hard for them to get a corporate job. Waiting to study wasn't an option because of financials.
Mm-hmm.
They can't just go to school and study because somebody has to pay the bills in Canada. And I believe in 1997, the economy wasn't the best.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard for them to get proper jobs. So they had to either work at factories at close to minimum wage. And I think back then the minimum wage was might be $7, $8.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had to work for cash for around $5 an hour.
Mm. And what did your dad do in India?
He was an architect. So he studied he was born in a village in Gujarat. He grew up in that village. He studied in a university through donations. So in India, you can actually get donations to study full. Like they would pay for your food, accommodation, meals, books, everything. And then when he did that, he moved to Mumbai. Found ways to live with someone. He was able to generate wealth, what he considered, like, you know, good amount of, like, he was able to buy a house, buy a couple of other properties in India quickly. And then by the time he was 35, he decided to come to Canada.
Which I'm sure it was a very different financial realm living in Toronto than it was living in Mumbai.
It was hard. It was hard because, you know, a dollar in India goes much longer than a dollar in Canada.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy growing up. Our budget was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just, and then also, you know, we would try to stay within or overly save rather than spend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, I think, the mindset my father grew up with. Save.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we made the most out of what we had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one thing that's come through to me since I've known you has always been the importance of family.
Yeah.
And that's been, like, at the forefront of everything. Even, you know, when we first met, you would bring your brother. You know, we met in an MBA program here in Toronto. And I think I met your brother pretty quickly afterwards because you guys were so close. You're real best friends as brothers, which is a very unique thing to see, to be completely honest.
For sure. I noticed that. I don't see that too much around. But I think it drives down from my father. I feel like he's very family oriented. Whatever he's done in his life was for his parents and his siblings.
Mm.
So he worked super hard. He got his siblings married, and back in India, that's a big expense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then also supporting them. And then growing up seeing that kind of puts it back on me as well. Like, hey, you know, that's something I've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's great. I feel like, I think one of the things I live by is, you know, you have very short time in this world.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to spend it with the people I care about the most.
Mm-hmm.
So even if we argue, fight, you know, I want to spend it with the people I care about the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know, right?
Absolutely. Nothing matters more than family.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
So spend as much time as you can with them, even though it might be more than anything else. But what else is there to do?
For sure. So your parents came over. It was not easy sailing. They, you know, as you said, weren't fluent in English. Your dad presumably couldn't continue being an architect.
No, he couldn't because, I mean, obviously there is education required in Canada. There's licenses that you need to do.
Yeah.
The language barrier didn't help him pass the test. And also the need for money, right? It's just like, hey, you can't just take a couple months off to study because then how are you going to pay the rent?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he wasn't able to, and I guess guidance as well. So we didn't know anyone else in Canada that can really guide us or what's here, what's there. So we lived in sort of a box. So we knew that, hey, money can be made in factory.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the first option. And then he did try. So eventually he got into immigration practice. So like how he came to Canada, he tried to bring other people to Canada as an immigration consultant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then eventually he tried to be an architect. So he went to school, studied, but it didn't turn off too well.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, convenience store, we had a convenience store.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that. We had a convenience store at the DuPont station.
Okay. Wow.
So we had a little shop there.
So your dad was a true entrepreneur. He was an entrepreneur.
Yeah, he was an entrepreneur, and that kind of drives down to both his kids, like me and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was also an entrepreneur. So
really?
He tried. Unfortunately, nothing hit it big, but he always was trying to do something.
Hmm. Very cool. Yeah, I think you told me once that Gujarati people are very famous for being entrepreneurial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, the last guy, or one of my recent guests, Adarsh, who you know, his last name actually means merchant.
Merchant.
And he's from Gujarat originally.
Yeah.
So why did you start your business?
So I didn't know it was going to be a business. So as soon as I graduated university, I got a job at CIBC. So I was working in banking. My brother was also working in banking. We wanted to create some side income, maybe a couple hundred dollars more a month. So we're like, hey, what can we do? Right? We always kept trying to do different things, work odd jobs. So after work, you know, find something to do. But then eventually we're like, hey, why don't we look at this new online stuff that's going on? And we started digging into that, and that eventually led to something big.
Well, I think the most hilarious story I have about when I first met you was, I remember it was one of our first classes in our MBA, and I remember you were very quiet in the class, as you are still, very shy at times. And you're sitting over on the side and you're always looking at your computer. And one day I came over and sat next to you and we started talking. And I remember looking at your screen and I thought you were trading stocks or, you know, derivatives or something like that. And I was like, oh, you know, nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. What do you do? And you're like, I sell stuff. So, which, you know, I've since then learned that that was probably the most humble explanation of having a huge e-commerce business and, as you said, now expanding into other industries. But can you maybe explain a bit more about what products do you sell? What is that e-commerce business look like?
For sure. So as a company, we have around 150 different websites. Each website may not be huge or heard of, but they might do around $1 million of sales. But then if you combine all 150, then it becomes a sustainable business. What we sell is we try to sell anything and everything. So we have websites for clothing, we have a website for kitchen utensil, we have a website for shoes, website for cell phone accessories, anything that we can build a website around, we do. Then we get a supplier that we can match the website with. And then we advertise on social media, Google, and then drive traffic to our websites, and whatever works, we try to scale.
Yeah. Again, very humble and simple way of describing an unbelievably complex and impressive business. But I guess, where did you start? What was the first product that you tried to sell?
So the first thing we ever did was not build our own website. We started supplying to companies that sold online. So when me and my brother were working at a bank, my first idea was, hey, why don't we create a website? You know, we can go door to door and promote that website. So we created something out of nowhere. And then the idea to go to door, going door to door didn't make sense to hand out flyers about the website. So we just searched around and then we saw a company called Groupon. And when I logged onto Groupon, there were random products and then beneath it, it said 10,000 sold, 20,000 sold, 30,000. It just didn't make sense that, you know, so many units of a particular product were selling on these daily deal sites. So there was one particular product. It was an iPad case that was selling. And my brother and I looked at it. We're like, hey, you know, maybe we can sell this as well on Groupon. So we tried to look for a local supplier that can get us this iPad case. And we fortunately found one in Canada. And let's just play with the numbers here. And he said, I'll sell you this iPad case for $10. So we said, we went back to Groupon. We're like, okay, we'll sell this on your website for $15. So we're making $5 margin per product. He's like, okay. So we went back to supplier. Everything was confirmed. And then overnight, we sold like 500 units. So Groupon listed it. We signed the agreement, you know. And it was a whole nervous process because my first time ever going to business venture. I'm 21.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing every minute somebody bought. So me and my brother were at the gym and we're like, oh, look, we made $5. We made $10. We made $15. So at the end, it was, I think, around 500 orders. And then when we did the math, we're like, oh, my God, we just made $2,500. This is what I make at the bank at the month.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to the supplier. And, you know, the supplier looked at us. We're like, oh, you know, we can't give it to you for 10 anymore. I have to charge you 20. And now we start freaking out. We're like, oh, my God, instead of making $2,500, we just lost $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
We both freaked out. We're like, what do we do? What do we do? My brother's like, okay, why don't we try to get it cheaper? So we just randomly started looking at the internet. And then there was a website called Alibaba. And then we found a particular supplier. And then instead of $10, which the original guy offered it for, we got it for $5.
Wow.
Again, we've never done this, so it was, we didn't know how to do this. So we talked to this person. They're like, hey, $5 a unit. We're like, oh, my God, we can make $5,000. We don't know who this person is. We've never met them. We've never seen their face. We just chatted with them online.
Mm-hmm.
We placed the order of 500 units, and we paid by Western Union.
Did they ever show up?
It showed up.
Wow.
And that was like, we were just like, whoa. We took the risk, right? We took the risk of $2,500. And that was from our credit card.
Crazy.
You know, we didn't have any of that. Like, it was, we paid it. And then 2 weeks later or 1 week later, it showed up at our doorstep. And we're like, wow, let's get packing.
That is unbelievable.
And then instead of making $2,500, our profit increased to $5,000.
Yeah.
So me and my brother were like, hey, you know, there's something here. We just made $5,000. All we did was pack orders. And it was funny because we took 500, we packed it at our house. Then we took 500 pieces, stuffed it in our car, and took it to Canada Post.
And
they were freaking out.
Yeah.
Because that's not the actual way to ship products. Like, you don't go to a Canada Post facility and drop 500 packages.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've learned the process after. But it was a very amusing start. And, you know, our eyes just lit up. We're like, oh, my God, we just made $5,000. So like Groupon, there were back in 2012, 2013, there were a lot of new startup daily deal sites. We're like, okay, you know what we got to do? We got to contact each one, find whatever we think we can get and start listing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. We just tried to contact everyone. We got super good at it. We undercut everybody. For us, it didn't, like, we were still working at banks, right? So it didn't matter if we made a profit or not from mm-hmm. from this. And, you know, even at $500 to us was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And most people in the industry wanted a 100, 200% margin.
Mm.
We were okay with 10% margin. Because, again, that's a lot of money to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're like, we quickly became one of the biggest online distributors for all these daily deal sites.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of began our journey, contacting each daily deal company and offering them anything and everything we can get our hands on.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And so how did you go from the daily deal sites to social media marketing driving traffic to your own websites like today?
For sure. So The journey was a couple of years, actually. You know, at first we had to understand that, hey, we actually got a business. So we were still working for the first year. First year revenue, we did $1 million+, which was unheard of. And then, you know, already we're making more in the business than I did at my job.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my brother had a better job than me. So he's like, why don't you quit first? So I quit. And then when I quit, the next year revenue 7 times. So we were like $7 million the second year, which also didn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
With good profit margins.
Yeah.
I was 15-20% profit margin. And then, you know, he quit.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
There's no point of him working either. So why don't we all just focus on his business? And then third year, we did $35 million. So it just 1735, it jumped. We're like, okay, you know, this is great. But eventually, like, the business model for these daily deal sites didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
We felt like they were just burning money to acquire customers.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, hey, why don't we, instead of going through a daily deal site, why don't we try to build something and go to the customers ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
So we already knew what was trending because we were the ones selling it on daily deal sites. We knew the products that were doing well.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we made a website around makeup brushes. And that was our first website. We're selling thousands of makeup brushes on daily deal site. We can make a website out of this. So we did that. And then we just experimented with Facebook ads. And this was when Facebook ads first started. So we were very lucky. And, you know, being at the right place, right time. Was you know, a lot of people say that, but I guess that really adds to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, sure, there was timing here, but also you guys were incredibly entrepreneurial to be taking these risks
yeah.
and going after these opportunities and making as large a bets on Facebook marketing. Like, I remember when Facebook marketing first came out, like when they were saying they were going to become a for-profit,
yeah.
you know, or they're, you know, turn on the monetization of Facebook.
Yeah.
Everybody was like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Who's going to advertise on Facebook, et cetera? And a lot of people were like very smart economists
yeah.
were, you know, saying it would never work.
But as soon as we tried, it worked. So we put in $10, we would get 100 back, right? When we first started, because nobody else was doing it. So it was like a wild, wild west.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity that we saw from the deal industry was great, but then this, when we switched on our own websites, one, we're building a customer base.
Mm-hmm.
We're doubling our profit per order.
Mm-hmm.
It just made sense. And then what we did was, it worked on makeup brush, so why don't we make another website on cell phone accessories?
Mm-hmm.
And then why don't we make another website on jewelry? So one after the other, we just kept launching more websites. The marketing funnel stays very similar throughout all these different websites.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't become more challenging to do. It just becomes more work. But the strategy on one website and the second websites are very similar.
And I told the story earlier of when we first met and you said, I sell stuff.
Yeah.
What I thought you were doing was trading stocks and
yeah.
derivatives. But what you were doing was
buying ads.
Yeah, exactly.
Buying ads and promoting our products.
And that was 2016,
yeah.
2017. So it was very, still again, early days for social media marketing.
Well, it wasn't early. I think that I would say that was the peak of it.
Really?
Yeah, I would say 2017, 2018 was the peak of Facebook marketing in terms of profitability. And then what right. happened was everybody started coming in.
So, yeah, so to clarify, you mean it was the peak of profitability for you.
Yes.
But then it was also when people first really understood it. And then after that, it's now become saturated.
For sure. And then with Facebook itself also, you know, not a lot of people knew about it. We were actually the beta subject for Facebook for a lot of different initiatives that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So because we were first on it, we were able to scale like nobody else could. And, you know, none of it made sense to us.
You once told me that you guys were one of the biggest Facebook buyers.
Yeah, top five easily.
In Canada?
And worldwide.
Insane. For Facebook ads.
Facebook ads, yeah, because it worked, right? So, and as my brother and I, whatever works, just keep going.
Insane.
Yeah, and the funny—
Did they ever reach out to say thank you for helping them prove their business model?
Well, I mean, Facebook has been always great. They've created an ecosystem for a lot of entrepreneurs to grow, and I really salute them on that. And they were appreciative. You know, we had good management team at Facebook. Everyone at Facebook was kind. They have a good culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we work together. We owe them. That's always the mindset I've had.
Mm-hmm.
Because of them, you know, our business grew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like you kind of proved their, you know, advertising model as well. So that's very impressive. How did you figure out how to use Facebook marketing?
Trial and error.
Yeah.
There was no— when we started, there was no guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kind of created the guidebook.
Wow.
So testing whatever works. But the most interesting thing was everything worked.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what you did, everything sold. And then back then when we first started, delivery time wasn't a big issue until Amazon did next day delivery. So back then, when internet sales first started, you know, 2 to 4 weeks delivery was a norm. Until Amazon changed it up. So it was easy for us to scale and making sure that customers are okay with it.
And where has your marketing gone since then? Is it still largely centered around Facebook? Do you now advertise with other social media?
So initially we started with Facebook. Now we try to do almost anything and everything's there. So we're really big on Facebook, Google, TikTok, Bing. So everything, I think, and that's very important. And I wish I knew that early on. In terms of increasing your profitability, it's good to have a 360 degree perspective on ads. Right? One channel is good, but when you combine all of them, it becomes even better.
How about influencers? Because I feel like you were really ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when you first told me, explained to me your use of influencers, I like didn't even understand what it was at the time.
Influencers are great. They're mini celebrities. They have a reach. And sometimes I feel like, at least when we first started, they didn't know their own value. So they were able to reach millions of people for just a couple $100s. Right? So we were one of the first people to start using mass influencers. We would contact them most of the time. What we would do is don't go after celebrities, but go after many influencers that might have 5, 10, 15,000 followers. Because a lot of those people are very legitimate and they have a following that's really legitimate and really look up to the influencer. So we would, and then it would be interesting because they don't really want too much money. You know, they're okay with a free product. So for $5, $10,000, I mean, like a product cost might be $10, $15. Send it to the influencer and they would promote your product. And then from that influencer, you'd get 30, 40 orders.
Yeah.
Right? So the return on investment for having an influencer was very cheap.
Crazy. Yeah. No, that's, you guys were, I really believe, at the forefront of social media marketing, both on the Facebook ads and the influencer. Like it was definitely for me when I first met you. That was what really opened my eyes to that being a legitimate channel, which now in retrospect, it's like the most obvious thing in the world. But you guys were real pioneers.
And for us, it was just a trial and error, right? Let's just try everything. Anything we can get our hands on, let's try it. And that kind of was one of the reasons we were able to grow, because we were open to try new things without looking back or looking at the consequence.
Yeah. In my previous discussion, I talked a bit with Darsh about the idea of failure and making mistakes and how important it was with business. It seems like you and your brother were completely impervious to making mistakes, like as in you made, I'm sure you made
them. I'm sure we made a lot of mistakes. But
it didn't slow you down.
It didn't slow us down because whatever money we were profitable, and whatever that we were profitable with didn't make sense to us. Right. So, you know, a little bit less profit, a little bit more profit. Back then, I wish I was more efficient because we wasted millions of dollars being inefficient. But we didn't care. because we, like, you know, none of it, like, the profitability that we were generating didn't make, like,
it was so dramatically different.
What we grew up with. So we were okay.
No, absolutely. So you talked a bit about the marketing side. How did the supply chain work? Because you're delivering, you're on the forefront of this marketing, you know, revolution, and you're killing it. How are you fulfilling these orders?
So we had a warehouse. So initially we started at our house. So we brought all the products to our house. We had a semi-detached house in Scarborough. So our basement, we used it as a storage facility. And then we picked, packed, and shipped from our basement. We would hire people from Kijiji. They would come into our house and help us pick and pack. Because initially, me and my brother were still working. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we would work from 9 to 5, come home by 6, 7, start packing until, you know, midnight. Mm-hmm. And then do customer service from midnight to 1, 2. And then wake up back at 6 a.m. and then repeat. So we did that for the first year until I quit. And then, you know, we moved into a bigger house, slightly bigger. So we moved to Brampton. We bought a bigger house. We had a bigger basement.
Nice.
So we filled up our basement. And then eventually we're like, hey, why don't we get a warehouse? So we bought our first 3,000 square foot warehouse. Where we picked, packed, and hired our first few employees. And then the unit, we were growing fast. The unit beside us came for sale. We bought it. We grew even more. The unit beside that, we bought it. And then in 2018, 2019, we bought another bigger unit, separate unit. Mm-hmm. And I think along with the business, these purchases of warehouses has been really fruitful for us as well. Mm. And then on top of that, in the last 10 years, we've been profitable and we put a lot of our profits back into real estate. So mm-hmm. we built a great real estate portfolio.
Yeah. So I want to touch on real estate, but let me finish on the supply chain side first. One of the things that, you know, you're a conundrum or an enigma ever since I've met you. And, you know, the I sell stuff and then you have, you know, orange Lamborghini. So, you know, very humble, but then, you know, it's this hilarious, polarized different views of the same person. But the one other thing that happened when we first met, we went to China as part of our MBA. And it was the first time you had actually visited your supplier in China. When me and you went there, and you'd been in business for at least a few years at that point.
I mean, with online, you don't really have to go and visit them. They can show you everything by video. Like, I mean, personal touch makes a big impact.
Yeah.
But a ticket to China was $3,000. Yeah. Or $2,000, and I didn't want to. And time and the need. For me, it's just like, hey, why do I need to go change? Everything's running smoothly as it is.
Yeah.
Why do I need to change what's working?
Yeah.
So I never really wanted to go until I had to go for my MBA program. And then it was such a good opportunity to meet someone, understand their culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, that definitely helped meeting them.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's – it fascinated me because, like, the world that you learn about in an MBA, it's so practical that, like, the pioneering entrepreneurship you guys do is the opposite of what they teach you in many ways, right?
Like, it is opposite. A lot of things I feel like we've learned in school, it's just very, like, book-focused, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't really utilize it. I actually did really bad in marketing, and that's one of the things I talked to my brother about. I got a D+ in marketing at my Schulich School of Business, and, you know, I spent a couple hundred million dollars marketing successfully.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what's that tell you?
Yeah. It's just because I guess academic and real life are two different things, right? Maybe I wasn't able to portray my ideas right. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm good at implementation, but not good at writing it down.
I sell stuff.
Yeah, I sell stuff.
Yeah. That, as a person who's an expert marketer, but then also someone who didn't do well in marketing, describing what you do as I sell stuff, I think sums that up. So I guess, you know, we've talked about the e-commerce business. Why did you get into the real estate side?
We were profitable, right? We were making money. Bank account was increasing. My brother's like, why are we going to keep cash in the bank? Let's put it somewhere, right? So every year we would buy 4 or 5 houses. And that was fun. That was fun, right? Like you go, you just drive around, be like, hey, let's go buy a house today. and we did that almost every year, And then Toronto real estate, and this is where we got super lucky because Toronto real estate tripled, quadrupled in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So our real estate portfolio grew faster than our business of e-commerce.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, insane.
So, I mean, like, you know, we're in e-commerce business, but I would say our biggest wealth gain was from our real estate portfolio.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. The value of diversification.
Yeah.
So it was your brother's idea to get into real estate?
Yeah, I mean, he's the one who made all the purchasing decisions on real estate. He would just wake up like, let's go buy some houses.
Incredible. So you guys, and you've used the word lucky many times, but also you've been incredibly tenacious and hardworking, et cetera, in order to be successful. What do you think the single most important thing is that's made you and your brother successful?
I think just wanting, you know, as growing up, we didn't have. So we always wanted things that we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So we were willing to work that extra hour or extra 5 minutes to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Also seeing our parents growing up, working hard, we're like, okay, we need to, you know, we only know to work. We don't know how to spend money. We know how to make.
Yeah.
We don't, like, you know, yeah, you mentioned the Lamborghini, but then most of the things we have are very, like.
Yeah. No, you're an incredibly humble person. That's just one of your signature trademarks, so I had to bring it up. So you've gone through the, like, most desired outcome for an immigrant. You know, you came here with your family when you were young. You struggled. Your parents struggled. They, you know, fought very hard to provide a good education for you and your brother. And you definitely did not waste that opportunity and, you know, have become an incredibly successful entrepreneur. What advice would you give to other immigrants who are, you know, coming to Canada and are also hoping to strike it out as being an entrepreneur?
I think the biggest advice would be to try new things. You know, get out of your box. Because if my brother and I were continuously in that box, we would still be working our factory jobs. Our family wouldn't have had growth, you know. We got good education. We were in banking. My dream was to become an investment banker. But then, you know, I excelled in marketing. So just being open, keeping your mind open, continuously learning, trial and error. Don't be afraid of all of that. Just whatever comes to your mind, do it, you know, rather than thinking of 100 reasons why it wouldn't work. Try it. If it doesn't work, then move on to something else that will. And that was our story as well. It's not like the first thing we tried was the e-commerce stuff. We tried 30 other things before that.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one actually just worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, it sounds simple, but to your point about 30 other things and you know, what we were talking about earlier with failure, it's not simple. It's incredibly difficult to go through what you've gone through and to keep going. Why do you think you and your brother have that tenacity? Is it from your parents? Is it cultural?
It's definitely I think culturally, yes, but I think it's from our parents. They work super hard. We've seen them work super hard throughout our life. So that kind of got built in us. why just sit and watch TV when you can work?
Fair enough.
Why sleep when you can work?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I get bored otherwise when we're not working. I mean, I don't know what, like, you know, me and my brother sometimes just sit and we're like, what do people do when they're not working?
Relaxing.
Yeah. Yeah, like, what do people do when they're not working? So we just wake up at 8 a.m. in the morning,
yeah.
7 a.m. in the morning, and we work until midnight every day. But then also, you know, we maintain our family values. It's not like we just work. We work with our family. So we're with them 24/7.
Yeah.
Right? We build that connection with the family. We're surrounded by them 24/7. So it's not like family time lacks. I feel like I do lack a social life where I don't go out or, you know, we don't go out as much. But then we're happy in a little bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, I mean, when you move into this stage of life where you now have your first child and yeah. your brother has kids and, you know, I'm in a similar stage, like, I don't go out either, you know? So it's, I think that's a pretty healthy bubble that you're in, really.
I mean, yeah, but we always contemplate that, right? We're like, okay. And I get social media has to do a lot with it. You know, you see all these people going out. And then I'm here working. It's just like, hey, should I be going out? Am I going to have a midlife crisis in like 5-10 years
yeah.
of not going out? But then again, like if I do go out, I'm kind of bored.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely not the same as when we were in our 20s.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Back to the e-commerce business. One of the other questions I had was, you know, when I met you, it was pre-Amazon doing next day shipping.
Right.
And pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody knows the story of what happened during COVID with e-commerce is like everybody started buying everything online.
Yes.
How is the, you know, e-commerce world post-COVID?
So there was a definite e-commerce boom, but instead of, let's say, 1,000 people selling online, now there's 1 billion people selling online. So it became super competitive. Initially, everyone's buying online, everyone is selling online. So everyone was profitable. But eventually, COVID stopped. So a lot of people stopped buying online, but now there's still 1 billion people selling online.
Yeah.
And everyone is trying to sell online. And that kind of makes the marketing auction expensive.
Yeah.
So in the past, to acquire a customer might have been a couple of dollars mm-hmm. when I first started. And that's what I meant. It was an amazing cash flow, right? Now, acquiring a customer can range from $30, $40, $50 to $300, depending mm-hmm. on the niche you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So it really changed, you know. And you can see that evidently in a lot of new e-commerce companies that go public, right? They go under very quickly.
Mm.
Or if you see the financials, they're losing millions of dollars every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense, right? Unless they get bought out. And, you know, if you see super successful stories, even like Dollar Shave Club, you know, I think it might have even got shut down. And their cost to acquire a customer was $300 per customer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's becoming much more challenging. And big brands like Coca-Cola, you know, they would spend billions of dollars advertising. They don't need to make a purchase. They just need brand awareness,
mm-hmm.
right? For someone who is DTC, direct to consumer, it's not as easy as it used to be now.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for new people who are trying to learn, it's not as lucrative as it used to be.
So then what's the next, you know, revolution, or what's the next thing as far as how are you going to take your e-commerce business to the next level?
I'm not. I feel like e-commerce business is still doing well for us, profitable. But I feel like it has reached a point where I don't see it, for myself at least, or my brother and I, we don't see it to be the next evolution for us. And that's why when I mentioned earlier, we started a satellite recruitment company.
Mm-hmm.
We feel like that could be the next thing that we can grow into, mainly because operational costs for Western companies is significantly high, and a lot of them are facing difficulties maintaining their overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, you know, HR is expensive in Canada and the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
An average employee or minimum wage keeps rising. Average good employee may cost $60,000, $70,000, $200,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
The same qualification of that same type of person in India would cost you 1/5, 1/6, right? And we did that with our business. We had overhead costs or HR costs of around a couple million dollars a year, and we reduced it by 5-6 times by moving our staff to offshore to India.
Hmm.
So we really want to offer this benefit to other companies where, you know, because, you know, I talk to a lot of business owners and a lot of them are struggling, right? And
yeah, it's a tough time.
It's a tough time. And, you know, and a lot of people are wanting to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of employees don't want to come to the office. So one of my thing is, why hire someone and pay them 10 times the amount in Canada when you can hire the same qualification, someone with a better willingness to work offshore. and you know, ever since we started, our retention rate has been insanely higher than what we had here. The culture we built is amazing.
How are you managing that? Are you spending time in India?
No, I'm not. you don't need to. I mean, we just make sure we hire the right people to manage the team. And they're all self-managed. I mean, they're proud to work for a company that's Western. It's, you know, they're happy about it. Comparatively, we pay higher than an average Indian company would pay people, mm-hmm. or higher than a multinational company like Google or Facebook would pay people in India. So these employees are more than happy to work with us. We're pretty flexible. We kind of implemented the Canadian culture in India. And India is the work environment in India is much harder.
Mm-hmm.
So having a company that's easier managed, they love it.
Hmm. Wow. That's really interesting. I didn't actually fully understand how that business was evolving. So you've just started that.
We started that earlier this year. We already have a client that we're recruiting for. And then we already have a second client in the pipeline.
And what's the name of that business?
It's in the music industry.
Okay.
Yeah, so they want
to... No, sorry, not your clients. The...
Hire Indian.
Hire Indian.
HireIndian.co. That's our website.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we're trying to grow. And I kind of got inspired by someone I talked to. So I'm in a YPO forum. And someone in my forum introduced me to their friend. So their friend had a logistic company, but they outsourced opened up a satellite office in Colombia. And when they sold their business, they kept their satellite office in Colombia to continuously support
mm-hmm.
that initial company he sold.
Mm-hmm.
So initially he started with around 20, 25 employees. 10 years down the road, now he has 10,000 employees managing hundreds of companies in the U.S.
Wow.
And you know, he's just saying that, hey, the demand is unlimited.
Mm.
He just doesn't know how to keep on the support. So that kind of inspired me. And I'm like, hey, if he's doing it in Colombia, then there's different talent in India that people might be looking for. And yes, a lot of companies are still doing this right now. I'm not the only one in this space, but I feel like, you know, you don't have to be the first in the market as long as you get share of the pie.
I'm Luke Hanson-McDonald. This was Beyond the Family Business. Please review and subscribe. Thank you very much. Talk to you next time.